A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel's been reading about statelessness, and it's thrown up three questions that sort of cascade into each other. First, how many stateless people are actually out there? Second, what are the main legal paths? How does someone end up with no country recognizing them? And third, if you're stateless, can you travel? And what document do you even use? That last one is the part that sticks with me. The idea of standing at a border with nothing that any state will stamp.
The number is one of those things where the official figure and the real figure are barely in the same conversation. UNHCR's latest estimate is about 4.4 million formerly stateless people globally, but that's widely acknowledged as a severe undercount. The real number is probably north of 10 million.
More than double.
And the gap isn't just bad data collection. It's structural. A lot of stateless people live in countries that don't report statelessness figures at all, or in situations where their status is never formally recorded. The Badoon in Kuwait are a good example. Estimates put them at over 100,000, but they don't show up in official statelessness counts because Kuwait doesn't recognize them as stateless. It considers them illegal residents or nationals of other countries who've hidden their real identity. So they're invisible twice over.
So the 4.4 million is basically the number of people who've been counted by someone, somewhere, as stateless, and there's a whole shadow population that's never made it into anyone's ledger.
And the definition matters here, because statelessness is a specific legal status. It's not just person without a passport, or person who can't prove where they're from. The 1954 Convention relating to the status of stateless persons defines a stateless person as someone who isn't considered a national by any state under the operation of its law. It means you don't just feel stateless or have trouble proving your nationality. The law itself, as written and applied, doesn't recognize you.
Which means we're talking about a legal void, not a bureaucratic inconvenience.
Right. And that convention, the 1954 one, is the foundational document. It says who counts as stateless, what rights they should have, and it provides for a travel document. But only 94 states are party to it. Compare that to the 1951 Refugee Convention, which has 146 parties. The gap between those two numbers tells you something about how much less attention statelessness gets.
So we've got at least 4.4 million people, probably more than 10 million, living in a legal category that fewer than half the world's countries have signed up to address. How do you actually end up there?
The most common path is something that sounds almost bureaucratic, gaps in nationality laws based on jus sanguinis, right of blood. Most countries determine citizenship at birth by descent. You're a citizen if your parents are citizens, which works fine until it doesn't. If your parents are themselves stateless, or if one parent's nationality doesn't pass down because of gender discriminatory laws, you can be born into a legal vacuum.
Walk me through the gender discrimination angle. That seems like it'd create a whole category of statelessness that's entirely manufactured by bad law.
More than 25 countries still have nationality laws that don't let women pass citizenship to their children on equal terms with men. So if a child is born to a mother who's a citizen of one of those countries, and the father is unknown, dead, or stateless himself, the child gets nothing. The mother's nationality simply doesn't transmit. There was a case a few years ago where a Malaysian woman living abroad couldn't pass her citizenship to her child born overseas because Malaysian law only allows fathers to confer citizenship by descent. The child was effectively stateless until the family fought it through the courts.
So the law creates a gap, and a child falls through it on day one.
And that's the thing about statelessness. A lot of it's generated at birth, silently, and the person might not even know until they try to get a passport at 16 or 18 and discover there's no country that will issue one.
What about the big historical events? Countries breaking apart, borders redrawing.
State succession is the other massive driver. When the Soviet Union dissolved in 1991, you had 15 new states all defining citizenship from scratch. Each one had its own criteria, language requirements, residency periods, ethnic definitions. hundreds of thousands of people fell through the cracks. Ethnic Russians who'd lived their whole lives in Estonia or Latvia suddenly weren't citizens of Russia because they weren't resident there, and weren't citizens of Estonia or Latvia because the new citizenship laws required proof of pre-1940 ancestry or passing a language exam. They became what's sometimes called non-citizens, a euphemism for stateless people with a residency permit.
The same thing happened with Yugoslavia.
Same pattern, different map, Yugoslavia breaks apart. New states emerge, each one defines who belongs. If you were a Serb living in Croatia, or a Croat living in Serbia, or mixed ethnicity, or from a region that got absorbed into a state whose ethnic definition of citizenship excluded you, you could end up with no nationality. South Sudan's independence in 2011 created a similar situation. People of South Sudanese origin who'd been living in Sudan for generations suddenly found themselves treated as foreigners by Sudan. But South Sudan's citizenship laws required proof of lineage or residence that many couldn't provide.
And then there's the version that's not about state collapse. It's about a state deliberately excluding a group.
The Rohingya are the textbook case. Myanmar's 1982 citizenship law created a list of 135 recognized national ethnic groups. The Rohingya weren't on it. Overnight, over 1 million people were legally defined as not belonging to the country where their families had lived for generations. They weren't stripped of citizenship, they were defined as never having had it. The law effectively retroactively erased their legal existence.
Which is a different mechanism from what happened in the Dominican Republic.
The Dominican Republic's 2013 Constitutional Court ruling is one of the most striking examples of retroactive statelessness. The court ruled that people born in the Dominican Republic to undocumented migrants, going back to 1929, were never entitled to citizenship, even though the Constitution had previously granted birthright citizenship. Tens of thousands of people, mostly of Haitian descent, who had Dominican birth certificates, Dominican ID cards, Dominican passports, were told those documents were issued in error and were void. They'd been citizens their whole lives, and then they weren't.
A court ruling, and suddenly you're nobody.
And that's the administrative horror of it. Even people who technically qualify for citizenship can end up effectively stateless if they can't prove it. Civil registries get destroyed in conflicts. Bureaucracies are inaccessible. You need to travel to a capital city, you need to pay fees you can't afford, you need documents that were never issued because you were born at home in a rural village. The law says you're a citizen, but the state won't recognize you as one because you can't satisfy the paperwork requirements. You're stateless in practice, if not in law.
So the paths are, born into a legal gap, a country breaks apart under you. Your government deliberately writes you out of the law, or the bureaucracy simply can't process you. None of those are things an individual can fix by themselves.
And that's what makes statelessness different from most other legal problems. There's no higher authority to appeal to. If a country denies you citizenship, you can't sue another country to take you. The international system is built on the assumption that every person has exactly one state that's responsible for them. Statelessness is what happens when that assumption breaks.
Which brings us to Daniel's third question. Once you're in that situation, can you actually go anywhere?
Yes, in theory. The 1954 Convention provides for a stateless person travel document. It's a booklet that looks like a passport, often blue, issued by the country where the stateless person legally resides. Article 28 of the Convention says states parties shall issue these documents to stateless people lawfully staying in their territory.
Shall issue? That sounds mandatory.
It is, on paper. But here's the catch. Only 94 states are party to the convention, and even among those, not all of them actually issue the documents. Some haven't set up the administrative machinery. Some interpret their obligations narrowly. A stateless person living in a country that hasn't signed the convention may have no legal path to any travel document at all.
So whether you can travel depends entirely on where you happen to live.
And even if you get the document, you face a whole second layer of problems. The travel document isn't a passport. It doesn't confer nationality, it doesn't give you consular protection, and it doesn't guarantee you entry anywhere. Most countries require stateless people to get visas for travel that citizens of their country of residence wouldn't need, and border officials are often unfamiliar with the document. They hesitate, they make phone calls, they pull you aside.
Which means you can get stranded.
That's the real nightmare scenario. You leave the country where you have residency, your travel document expires while you're abroad, and suddenly you have no valid document and no country that's obligated to let you back in. The country that issued the document might renew it, but you have to get there first. And if you're stuck in a third country with an expired stateless person travel document, you're in a legal no man's land that most immigration systems simply aren't designed to handle.
So the document exists, but using it's a calculated risk every single time.
That's why most stateless people never leave the country they live in. It's not that they're legally prohibited from traveling. It's that the practical barriers are so high and the consequences of something going wrong are so severe that the rational choice is to stay put. Statelessness becomes a mobility trap.
If the country you're trapped in is persecuting you.
That's where the distinction between statelessness and refugee status becomes critical. A refugee has a well-founded fear of persecution and is protected under the 1951 Refugee Convention. Many refugees are also stateless, but many stateless people aren't refugees. They're not fleeing persecution, they're just legally unrecognized. And the protections for stateless people who aren't refugees are weaker. The 1954 convention has fewer parties, fewer enforcement mechanisms, and less institutional support. UNHCR has a mandate to protect stateless people, but it's not the same robust framework that exists for refugees.
You're stuck in a country that may be treating you terribly, with no legal right to go anywhere else, and no document that would let you if you tried.
Stateless Palestinians are a particularly stark example of this. Palestinians in Lebanon, many of them are stateless. They hold travel documents issued by Lebanese authorities, but those documents aren't recognized by many states. They face severe mobility restrictions. They can't get citizenship in Lebanon because Lebanese law explicitly excludes Palestinians from naturalization. They can't return to what's now Israel. They can't get Palestinian Authority passports because they're not registered as residents of the West Bank or Gaza. They're in a legal box with no exit.
This isn't a small population we're talking about.
The UNRWO registered Palestinian refugee population is several million people across multiple countries. Not all are stateless, but a significant portion are, particularly those in Lebanon and Syria. And the legal architecture around Palestinian statelessness is uniquely complicated because it's tied up in the unresolved political status of the Palestinian territories and the specific mandate of UNRWA, which operates separately from the broader UNHCR refugee framework.
Daniel's travel question, can they travel? The answer is yes, technically, with a document that exists, but only if they live in one of the countries that issues it, and only if the destination country recognizes it, and only if nothing goes wrong. That's a lot of conditions stacked on top of each other.
Each condition is a point of failure. I remember reading about a stateless man who'd lived in Europe for years with a convention travel document. He needed to travel for a family emergency, got to the airport, and the airline staff had never seen the document before. They refused to let him board. He missed the flight. By the time it was sorted out, the emergency had passed.
The document is valid, but the person holding it's at the mercy of whoever's checking it.
Which is true of passports, too, but a passport is backed by a state that can make phone calls on your behalf. A stateless person has no consular support. If something goes wrong at a border, there's no embassy to call. You're on your own.
1993. I was checking documents for a small charter airline out of Riga. We flew old Tupolevs around Eastern Europe, mostly migrant workers, some family visits, the occasional cargo of who knows what in the hold.
What kind of volume were you seeing?
Maybe 3 flights a day. Not busy. Which is why I remember the one time a man handed me a travel document I'd never seen. It was a 1954 convention booklet issued by Latvia. Blue cover, but it had this purple stamp on page 4, a rectangle with rounded corners, some kind of internal verification mark. I'd handled Soviet passports, new Latvian passports, Russian Federation passports, the great aliens passport Latvia was issuing to non-citizens. Never seen that purple stamp before or since.
Did you let him through?
I called the German embassy. It was a Saturday. Took 40 minutes to get someone who knew what I was describing. They confirmed it was valid. Said they'd seen a few of them, mostly from the Baltics. The man was Latvian-born, ethnic Russian. Didn't qualify for citizenship under the new law. Didn't have Russian residency either. He was traveling to Frankfurt to see his daughter. She'd married a German and gotten out. He hadn't.
And then what happened?
The pilot wouldn't take him. Said the document didn't look right. I had to go out to the plane and explain to a man who'd flown Soviet military transports for 20 years that this piece of paper was a real travel document, even though he'd never seen one. He wasn't convinced. I told him I'd take responsibility. He grunted and said fine, but if the Germans sent the plane back, he was filing a report naming me personally.
Did the man make it?
I don't know. The flight left. I never saw any report about it. I think about that sometimes. Whether he got to see his daughter, or whether he got held up at the other end and I just never heard about it. The airline folded about 8 months later. Records are probably in a basement somewhere in Riga, if they exist at all.
The purple stamp, was that something Latvia added unilaterally?
Must have been. The convention doesn't specify stamps. Each issuing country does its own thing. That's part of the problem. There's no standard format. A border guard in Germany sees a travel document from a country he's never dealt with markings he doesn't recognize, and he's supposed to just accept it. Some do, some don't.
The document's validity depends on the individual human being who happens to be at the desk that day.
It depends on whether they've seen one before. Most haven't.
That story captures the whole problem. The law says the document is valid. The infrastructure to make that validity real, the training, the standardization, the institutional knowledge, doesn't exist at the level it needs to. So you have a legally valid document that's practically unreliable.
The man in Hilbert's story had a daughter willing to take him. Most stateless people don't have a destination country waiting for them at all. The travel document is necessary, but not sufficient. You need someone willing to let you in, and most countries treat stateless applicants as a risk.
The visa problem is huge. A German citizen can travel to something like 190 countries, visa-free or with visa on arrival. A stateless person with a convention travel document, even one issued by Germany itself, faces visa requirements for almost everywhere. And visa applications ask for proof of ties to your country of residence, proof of funds, proof of return. A stateless person often can't provide the same documentation a citizen can. The application gets denied and the travel document sits in a drawer.
We've got a document that technically enables travel, but the system around it erodes its usefulness at every step. Issuance gaps, unfamiliarity at borders, visa barriers, no consular backup, and catastrophic consequences if anything expires or gets lost.
That's before we even get to the question of what happens when a stateless person's country of residence simply won't issue the document. There are stateless people living in countries that haven't signed the convention. They have no legal mechanism to get any travel document at all. They're not just practically immobile, they're legally immobile.
If you take one thing from this discussion, it's that statelessness isn't a rare edge case. It's a structural feature of how nationality law works, affecting millions of people, and the legal tools that exist to address it are patchy, undersubscribed, and unevenly applied. The travel document exists, but it's a half measure. It solves the problem of having no passport without solving any of the problems that make having no passport dangerous.
The thing that sticks with me is the gap between the convention's language and the reality Hilbert described. States shall issue is mandatory on paper. But a pilot who doesn't like the look of the document, a border guard who's never seen the stamp, an embassy that takes 40 minutes to answer on a Saturday, those are the real adjudicators of whether a stateless person gets to move. The law says yes. The world, a lot of the time, says no.
What happens when a country physically disappears? I keep thinking about low-lying island nations. Tuvalu, Kiribati, the Maldives. If sea level rise makes them uninhabitable and the territory is gone, what happens to the nationality? There's no legal framework for a state that ceases to exist due to climate change. You could have entire populations becoming stateless, not because of any legal gap or discriminatory law, but because the land itself is underwater.
That's the open question that keeps me up. The international system assumes states are permanent. They can merge, split, be conquered. But the idea that one simply vanishes with its population dispersed across other countries is new. There's no convention on climate, induced statelessness. There's not even a serious draft. And we're looking at scenarios where this could happen within decades, not centuries.
Nationality is something most of us never think about until we need it. And by then, if you don't have it, it's already too late.
This has been My Weird Prompts, thanks to our producer Hilbert Flumingtop.
If you want to send us a question like Daniel did, email the show at show@myweirdprompts.com. We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep, the stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close, from sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.